Well, it's always a pleasure to be here. We were talking about that last week at home, and I think if I calculated right, we've been coming up here since 1963. So for those of you that are younger, that's a long time.
And you're old.
That means I'm old. But I am thrilled to be here. It's always a pleasure to be in this body and see, as it has been through the years, the young coming in and providing strength and energy and excitement. And we are thrilled to be here. Well, octane level was a message that was given to me. Knowing what that topic was, I decided to do an image search for some kind of inspiration, perhaps. So I type octane level in, and this is what I get. Not very helpful, unless, of course, I'm trying to decide which of those hoses I'm supposed to use for my car. So I try again, try typing in octane level. However, I mistype, and I get a G in there instead of a V, and so this pops up. Well, you might like to know that this fellow's name is Octane. And he's the Fast and Furious Octane and one of Apex Legends, that's a computer game that I know nothing about, most aggressive characters, a quick and deadly legend capable of closing the gap between you and your opponents rapidly before they know what hit them. There you are, octane level. So I try it one more time, and knowing the secret word for what I'm really supposed to talk about, I put that in also with octane legend level, and I get this. Now, it's a little better. Can you read it? Yeah, we can't read it. Yeah. The idea of being there in the DMV for that long enough to grow that beard. And the rest of the story goes kind of like this. So our bearded friend, our bearded gentleman, having spent hours enduring the long lines, dealing with the surly clerks, trying to understand the insane regulations of the Department of Motor Vehicles, he finally heads home and stops at a toy store to pick up the birthday gift for his son. He brought his selection, a baseball bat, to the cash register, and the lady up there said, "Cash or credit?" very politely, and he responds, "Cash!" And then he apologizes and says, "I'm sorry, that was very rude, but I've just spent my entire afternoon at the DMV and I'm a little frazzled." She, in a very soft voice, says, "Well, shall I gift wrap the bat, or are you going back there?" Now we're getting closer. Octane level, our anger. The Bible talks about anger and how man's anger does not do the works of righteousness. And in fact, even those companions we have who are angry do not help us in our service to God. The Bible is very clear about that. So this afternoon, we're going to explore the layers of our anger. We're going to try to understand what's going on, address some of the emotions beneath the anger, and how to deal with them in a healthy and godly manner. So welcome to the two-day seminar on dealing with anger. Actually, not quite that long, so we'll have to cut a lot of it short. So what we're going to do is we're going to stay in one place. If you have Bibles, if you would like to open up to Matthew, the fifth chapter, verse 20 through 26, we're going to be looking at those verses almost exclusively, except for a few outliers. Now, I know some of you have Bibles, some of you have electronic things, and at our home congregation, I always invite people just to listen. Because there are a lot of different translations, and I'm going to use the God's Word translation, which is a very contemporary translation. And it may be confusing if you're trying to follow along. But I ask people just to listen because, you know, that's how it was in the first century. They didn't have a copy in front of them. They just had to listen to the man speaking that was reading the message that came through. And that was how they learned. They just simply listened. And we've kind of lost that. And so some of you won't feel comfortable, so go ahead and follow along the best you can. But know that I'm inviting you to just sit back, close your eyes even if you want, and just listen to the words of the Bible. I can guarantee that unless you live a life that has God's approval and do it more faithfully than the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to your ancestors, never murder. Whoever murders will answer for it in court. But I can guarantee that who is ever angry with another believer will answer for it in court. Whoever calls another believer an insulting name will answer for it in a higher court. And whoever calls another believer a fool will answer for it in hellfire. So, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and remember there that another believer has something against you, leave your gift at the altar. First, go away and make peace with that person. Then, come back and offer your gift. Make peace quickly with your opponent while you're on the way to the court with him. Otherwise, he'll hand you over to the judge. The judge will hand you over to an officer who will throw you into prison. I can guarantee this truth. You will never get out until you pay every penny of your fine. You might want to keep your finger there because we're going to kind of dissect this as we look at this process called octane level anger. The reality is we do crazy sometimes. We just do. We don't intend to. But we say things, we do things. We stuff things down inside of us until all of a sudden they blow up. And we just do crazy. We allow our anger to take over our lives for a short period of time. And then we wish we could take it all back. We're sorry. We really are. Sorry. We have said things that we know we can't put back in our mouths. We have done things that we know that we can't undo because our eyes have seen them. We destroy things or people. Anger, I believe, is one of the most destructive things in our life and in our society. You just have to pay attention, just have to pay attention to the news feeds. Almost every day, there is something that's going on because somebody got angry. And it goes everywhere. Take an actor. Somebody's going to get angry and do something stupid. A sports figure. A man of faith, even. Neighbors. We have guns showing up in situations where words hadn't even had a chance to figure out what was going on. That's anger. So how is it that we deal with all of these emotions? How can we peel back that? Well, I think Jesus gives us some information about anger that we ought to pay attention to. And that's what I'm going to try to disseminate to you in this just short time that I feel is critically important for us. Because I've seen anger, and I have felt anger, and I know it's not right. So, what does Jesus do? Well, I would propose to you that in Matthew 5, 21 through 48, Jesus actually gives us six examples of what happens when people get angry. And you might not have thought about that before, but this is a topic that I have really worked on in the past in a lot of different ways. Jesus, in these passages, talks about murder, adultery, divorce, breaking your oath, an eye for an eye, and hating your enemies. And I would suggest that all of those are connected with anger in some way. Anger at someone else, anger at yourself, anger about a situation. Something is going on that you are angry about and you don't know what to do with it. And so I think as we look at this, Jesus gives us some good things to do and to think about. You know, Jesus said as he was talking there in that passage that the Pharisees look good on the outside. We have to acknowledge that. Now, oftentimes we just get this sense that, well, oh yeah, Pharisee, bad. You know, scribe, bad. Well, that was just a few. That wasn't all of them. Because as we follow through, we see that there were Pharisees who believed in Jesus. There were scribes who believed in Jesus. And we see that priests believed in Jesus as we go through the book of Acts. They came to understand. They weren't all angry at Jesus or fighting his will. But Jesus says that we have to have our righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. That means there's a level of righteousness that's already there. If we have to exceed it, you have to have something to exceed. And so we need to understand what we're going to be doing there. So we're going to look at Matthew 5:21. Look at the sixth commandment. Do not murder. Now, when Jesus started that teaching there on the Sermon on the Mount, I'm sure a lot of people felt really good. You know, Jesus said, you know, we've got some righteousness, and the thing to do is not murder. Hey, I'm pretty good at that. Don't raise your hand, I guess. But most of us, I'm sure almost all of us, have been in a position where we've not murdered anybody. And if that's our guideline, then, hey, we're all doing great, aren't we? We haven't done it. But Jesus wasn't finished there, as we know. It is a good beginning, but it's not the standard we want to set for our righteousness. Jesus' intent is way more personal than just murder. So as we look at the effects of anger on our lives and the lives of others, and how it impacts our relationship with God, hopefully we'll have a better understanding of why Jesus started with this subject, which is horrendous. Murdering someone would be horrendous. I personally know one person who was involved in an accident that caused the death. They were not in fault, but it caused the death of someone else. And that was a hard thing for them to live with. Even though it wasn't their fault, someone still died. This is a big deal. How do we figure it out? And why did Jesus raise this bar so high? Well, I think there's a progression of anger that's general. It can go different directions, but I think if we understand the general progression, that'll help us see where we're going. Three steps, I believe, in anger that Jesus talks about right here in this passage. He first begins with anger without a just cause. Everyone who is angry with his brother without a cause will be subject to the judgment. Now, the Pharisees read the law, and it said, do not murder. And not having murdered anyone, they probably felt pretty righteous. However, they were just on the verge because they were angry enough with Jesus that they would later plot his death. Now, they wouldn't actually do the deed, but they were in on it. They made it happen. You know, one of the classic examples is the man with the withered hand that we find in three of the Gospels. On that Sabbath day, they purposefully brought him in so they could catch him in something. And the passage says there in Luke 6 that they were filled with rage. In Matthew 12 and Mark 3, it says after that, they plotted to kill him. It angered them so much that they were ready to do away with him. And they had to figure out how to do it so that they wouldn't receive the blame. The Apostle John would write in 1 John 3:15, "Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer." Just stop for a moment. Let that sink in, folks. Brothers and sisters, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. What a horrible thing for us to think about. But think about hatred. And think about times you have been angry at someone. And where did it go? How did it stop? What was your response? It's a hard lesson. It is stuff that touches our lives. For you see, Jesus deals not just only with the act of murder, but the attitude that's there. Because murder doesn't start with the knife in the heart. Murder starts with the heart, and then it moves out. And that's what we have to keep in mind, to know that it's inside of us that we need to be aware of. The second level, the second progression, if you will, is the idea of contempt. And whoever says to his brother, "Fool," will be subject to the Sanhedrin. The first step in anger was a process that was kind of silent. We do that, first of all, by just kind of keeping it within us. We let it vegetate in there, and it just kind of gets sour, and we got to do something with it to get rid of it, but we don't know quite what to do with it. Well, if it's in there long enough, then we begin to understand that something is going to happen, and this is what happens. It moves up into something that goes out of us rather just inside of us. The word there, rock is one word, or fool, is any insulting name. It can be the word idiot, empty fellow, senseless, stupid. All our words are words that are descriptive against someone, aren't they? And it's important for us to understand that words are there. Our oldest grandson, Stephen, when he was in first grade, he was out on the playground. He and two other friends were over on the side, and the teacher on duty heard a curse word from his group. It started with an S. She went over to that group and asked those three boys, "Which of you said that curse word?" None of them. So it was that time in history where the teacher took them to the principal. The principal, "Which of you three boys said that word?" Nothing. And so the principal called all three parents to say, "Parents, I need you down here. This is behavior that's unacceptable. We need to figure it out." So Christy got there, listened to the story, and she said, "Well, here's what you do. Just ask Stephen, what's the bad S word?" So the principal looked at Stephen and said, "Young man, which word begins with an S? That's a curse word." And Stephen looked at him and said, "Stupid." In their family, Christy absolutely refused to let the brothers call each other stupid. If you wanted the wrath of Christy, the mom Christy, on top of you as a son, you just call a brother stupid. And she was all over you. That was not acceptable in her house. She understood the value and the power of that word, and she was not going to allow it. That's what Jesus is talking about here. The power of a word that makes a difference. And you don't allow it. You don't consider it. It just doesn't stay there. Jesus teaches the use of such words is the same as violating the sixth commandment. In other words, it's the equivalent of murder. Let's pause again. We just got to keep this in mind, folks. Saying an insulting word to someone else, a brother or sister, a neighbor, to put them down in some way, in God's eyes, is you might as well have just taken the knife and stabbed him in the heart. That's how bad anger is. That's what God sees. That's His call to us to look at the emotions that are within us and what we need to do to protect our hearts and minds there. And then there's a third level. And I'm just calling it a settled hatred. But whoever says you moron will be subject to hellfire. You notice those ramp-ups. They started just with a council and then the Sanhedrin and then hellfire. Because anger doesn't back off, does it? Unless you take care of it, it's in there and it just keeps going and it keeps going and it keeps going. Moron or fool, morally worthless to curse someone. The term "you moron" is a translation of a statement that denotes a fixed and settled hatred for another person. A fixed and settled hatred for another person. That means your life is all about making that other person miserable. Making that other person pay. Finding some way to put them down. That's what your life is about. Fixed and settled hatred. Someone who calls a person a moron scorns him, scorns his heart, his character. This expression is an utter disregard for a fellow man's position in the eyes of God. You're disparaging one of God's creation, and God is not happy with that. That is not something that is acceptable in Him. And that's why this offense is equal to murder. And does it make sense? Sure. It's not only the message that was in that Sermon on the Mount. In James 3, 9 and 10, the writer there, speaking about the tongue, says, "We praise our Lord and Father with it, and we curse men who are made in God's likeness with it." Praising and cursing come out of the same mouth? My brothers, these things should not be this way. I've been in situations where brothers have not talked so gently to each other. That's not the way it should be. That's what James said. That's what Jesus said. And so the progression of honor, of anger, also gives us a sense of false view of ourselves. Because you see, the Pharisees thought they were righteous. They were angry, but they thought they were righteous. They thought they were okay. They had the anger going for them. But hey, no. Jesus said that's not it. When we're angry with people, many times we don't see the problem because, first of all, we start with it inside ourselves. So we pretend. We put on a fake face. And yet in the inside, we're seething with this anger. We can't get rid of it. We don't know what to do with it. And eventually, it's got to come out. Because we have to do something. And so Jesus scolded the Pharisees over being clean on the outside, but dirty on the inside. In Matthew 23:25-26, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisees. First clean the inside of the cup, so the outside of it may also become clean. That could be talking about the way we deal with anger inside of us. I mean, we can keep anger way hid for a long time. And on the outside, we look clean. But on the inside, we're just full of what Jesus says is greed and self-indulgence. That's where we are with this anger. And so the progression of our anger is without just cause to begin with, and then contempt, and then a settled anger, a settled hatred. But that's not the end of anger. And this is the thing that I think, I don't know, if you're labeling things and saying, number one, worst, number two, worser, and the worstest. I don't know how you would do that. But this might be the worstest, because anger directly impacts your worship to God. And that's something to cause pause. To look at my life and say, if I'm that angry, what's going on between me and God? What's happening here? So let's look at that passage. Matthew 23:24. So he says, if you're offering your gift on the altar, and there that you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and reconcile with your brother, then come and offer your gift. It seems to me that Jesus is saying, if you're coming to the fellowship to worship or to pray, and you know that there's a brother or sister that is not feeling right about you, it seems to me Jesus is saying, I don't want you to walk through the door. I want you to go find that brother or sister and see what you can do to make it right. Whatever it takes, you just do it. You attempt to fix the problem. Then you come back and join in the fellowship. Take care of that. And it's a challenge, because if we are harboring that anger and it's caused somebody else to be, or it's caused somebody else to be angry, it means that we're losing fellowship with each other and with God. And that's not a good place for us to be. Interestingly, as you look at that passage, in this particular case, the focus is not on the worshiper's anger, is it? It's on the other person's anger about their issue and how they feel toward you. And Jesus explained that the worshiper remembered someone else's anger or concern or something that was upset. And he doesn't even say that they were right. He just simply says, if you remember someone has something against you, right or wrong, it is your job to go fix it. Before you do anything else, go fix it to the best of your ability. See how you can bring something together with people. And then that will be great. So first, go and be reconciled. And that really is what we're talking about. How do you deal with anger? Well, you recognize it, and then you go and get reconciled. Whatever that takes. And that's not easy. It means to settle the difficulty, to make proper acknowledgement or satisfaction for the injury. If you owe someone a debt, and that's why they're angry, pay them. Just do it. Figure it out. Whatever it takes, pay him so that's taken care of. If you've injured his or her character, well, confess it and ask for forgiveness. Seek pardon. If they're under the impression that your conduct has hurt them, then talk about that impression. Tell them that was not your intent. Try to find some way to share that so that you understand. It's not always possible. As a teacher, I had lots of conferences with parents. And almost always except once, was I always able to, when they would come in wondering why little Johnny was failing and what was I doing wrong, I could turn it around and show them the information and then ask, how can we work on this together? You and I team up to help little Johnny do a better job. And I could almost always turn that around. There was one time I couldn't. It was a sixth grade girl. She didn't get the grade she wanted. She came home and trashed the project that was, she got the C on, and sat on the front porch crying when Daddy got home. And I talked to Daddy. He came in. He was upset. He was pretty convinced and said so in front of my principal and myself that I was the worst teacher in all of Shawnee Mission Schools. Well, there were about, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 of us, so I didn't figure I was really the worst. But as far as he was concerned, I was the worst. And I simply asked, what can I do to make this right? And he said, nothing. Sometimes you can't do anything. But I was still apologetic. I was still seeking to find a way through. And I think that's what we're talking about here with our anger, with somebody else's anger. We have to figure out what we can do, if anything at all. Because really, the focus is on the other person. It's not about you. Come on, folks, it's not about you. It's about somebody else. Isn't that what we talk about? Jesus first, yourself last, others in between. It's not about you. It's about your brother or sister. It's about getting into their life to understand why there's this connection that's not working. It's about you. You may not be wrong. You may be in the right. But if they still feel that way, it's still about you and them. I have no trouble apologizing and saying I am wrong, even if I know I'm not. Because it's not about me. God knows what I did. He understands my principles, my guidelines, what I did, why I did it. And if I'm comfortable with that, then it doesn't make any difference how somebody else perceives me. But I always start with, I'm so sorry this happened. What can I do to make it better? What can I do to help? Because I want that relationship so much. Well, anger and worship is not, this dichotomy is not a new principle. Back in Micah, the 6th chapter, the prophet was writing about the people's complaining about what was going on and why God wasn't listening to them. And he writes all this up. But in verse 8, he says, the prophet's writing, mankind, he has told you what is good and what is the Lord's requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God. Three things. And if you'll do those three things, anger will not stand a chance. If you will act justly, love faithfulness, and walk humbly, anger does not stand a chance. From Micah and Matthew, we learn the following things. That in order to defeat anger, we need to be just to all of our fellow man, to be acceptable before them in a way that shows us. We need to live peacefully with those and make sure that they hear what's going on. We need to humbly seek reconciliation. And the bottom line is, none of those three can be done if you're angry. They don't work. They are contradictory to each other. You have to get rid of anger in order to live the way God would have you live. And so, the path of reconciliation, we've kind of touched on it, but let's look at it just quickly again. When he says, leave your gift there in front of the altar, first go and be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Reach a settlement quickly with your adversary while you're on the way with him, or your adversary will hand you over to the judge to the officer, and you'll be thrown into prison. I assure you, you will never get out of there until you have paid the last penny. So, two easy steps. One is, first go and be reconciled. We talked about that. That's your responsibility. You see it, you feel it. They don't want to talk to you. They don't shake your hand. They run out the door. They ignore you. There's something going on. You need to figure it out. It may not, because they may think it's your fault. So you go do that. It means that we be Christ-like enough to go to the person we wronged or feel like we have wronged them and make it right. And the second step is really interesting. That seems like it's all our responsibility. But the second step is interesting when he says, reach a settlement quickly. So if my brother has something against me, it is his job to come get me. See, there's both sides to this. If you have something against a brother, if you think someone has put you down, has disregarded your feelings, Jesus also says it's your job. It's not the other guy's job. It's your job. And this is the reason. In this society, in Jesus' day, if you had an issue with someone, it was your job to get him to the judge. You couldn't just complain. If you wanted justice, you needed to go to that person and get them and bring them to the judge. And so Jesus is saying, both of you have responsibilities. If you think there's a problem, you need to try to fix it. If you have a problem with somebody else, you need to go talk to them. And that's the reason he says, reach a settlement quickly with your adversary. Because the person that thinks you're wrong, he's the one that's had to reach out to you, and he's taking you to the judge. So you try to get on his good side quick. Before you get to the judge, figure it out. It's up to you. Look for that. Reach that settlement. And I'm way behind. There's one more level of anger that I want to talk about. And it is what I am calling a sanctified anger. It's an anger that's channeled in the right direction. And we use this. I've heard people use this. Ephesians 4:26, be angry and do not sin. We always love that passage. I've heard so many people say, oh, it says you can be angry and not sin. Yeah. Have you tried that? Seriously? Have you really tried that? To be angry and not sin at the same time? Oh, come on, folks. That doesn't work. We forget what it says. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. And don't give the devil an opportunity. So how does that work? Well, Jesus dealt with this situation. And we've already talked about the man with the paralyzed hand and being brought. And Jesus asked, can we heal on the Sabbath? And they wouldn't answer him. And it says there, as we go through that, that after looking around at them with anger and sorrow at the hardness of their hearts. Well, he was angry at them, all right. But he was so sad that it had gotten to that point for those folks to be so hard. So, be angry? Yeah. But your anger is going to be sorrowful. You're going to be sad to be that angry. So what does it look like? Jesus was tempted in all points. And that was one of them. But he never sinned. Jesus became angry. And he never sinned in that. It was a sanctified anger. A channeled anger. An anger that had the right focus. And the right object. So I got thinking about that. So, okay. So what can a Christian be angry about? I want to be angry about something, Dan. Tell me what I can be angry about. Well, Let me give you some suggestions. You can be angry about the inhumanity of human trafficking. Get angry about that and do something about it. You can be angry about the devastation caused by pornography. Figure out how to get in there and support your community. You can be angry over the millions of abortions in our country. You can be angry over the abuse and devastation of alcohol and drugs. And you can be really angry about the millions of people who are dying without knowing Christ as their Savior. There are some things you can be angry about and be really sad about and say, I need to channel this anger some way to make a difference. That's a sanctified anger. And quite frankly, in all my years, as I sat down and thought about this, I could never think of a person who I felt displayed a sanctified anger. Maybe you know it. If you've had that experience, I'd love for you to share it with me. I think it's unusual. I think we use that passage way too much. I think when we use that passage next time, you need to think about it. Okay, here are some things I can be really angry about. Angry and don't sin. Well, here are some things I can be angry about and not sin. It's not easy. So, be angry and don't sin. Don't let the sun go down in your wrath. Don't allow the devil to have a foothold in your life, because that's what anger can do if it's not probably monitored. But channel that anger so it can begin to accomplish victories for Jesus. And so we come now to the conclusion. Let's remember that Jesus said our righteousness needed to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees if we're going to enter heaven. Most people seem to think that if they stand before God and they say, well, you know, I hadn't murdered anybody, God, that's pretty good. But quite frankly, think about this. Will you stand before God and say, God, I've never been angry at anybody? Never been angry at anybody? Never taken my anger out on anybody? That's what we need. We need to rise above that. We need to be more than that. Jesus wants our hearts to be pure as well as our actions are pure. He desires worship, not religion. He wants worship in our lives. And we need to understand that harboring anger has devastating effects on ourselves, on our loved ones, in our houses, in our neighborhoods, in our churches, in our fellowship. That anger is something terrible. So, let your anger go. Give it to Jesus. That sounds simple, doesn't it? Let it go, give it to Jesus. Anger, like a lot of other things in our life, is a decision. You decide if you're angry or not. You decide if it's worth all that energy. You make that decision every day about what you're going to do with it. So, be responsible. But Jesus understands. And I say this, because He understands what it's like to have all that anger directed at you. He knows what anger is. He understands how anger can destroy and change a person's countenance and their face and their heart. And He doesn't want that for you. Not at all. So let me close with a prayer with you, if you will. Heavenly Father, as we close this sermon out, help us to not sin in our anger. Gracious God, if I am harboring hatred or anger toward another, give me a spirit of forgiveness. Our merciful Father, if I know or suspect that a brother or sister has something against me. Bless me with humility so that I may move forward in reconciling us and our relationship with you. And holy God, help us to have a sanctified anger toward the sin in this world, and give us wisdom in dealing with it. And Almighty Father, help us to be aware of the lost around us. In Jesus' blessed and holy name, and amen. And that's finished, but I have one more thing to share. And I appreciate that. Gaylene is not with me. She no longer travels. And quite frankly, this was a rough decision for me to come, because it's going to be 9 hours since I was with her. And I've not been that far away from her for a year and a half. In January of 2023, she had some kind of an incident where she couldn't put a sentence together. Looked like a stroke. A neurologist has said it was a stroke. But it passed in 2 hours. It was gone. But what it did, it changed her brain. She no longer can remember immediate things. She asks what day it is, 4, 5, 6 times a day, what we're doing. She still is delightful. She's not upset that she has to ask or that she can't remember, which is such a blessing to me. And one particular very bad day, when asked what she could remember and she couldn't remember things, she looked at me and she said to the people around, "Well, he's my husband and his name is Dan." And boy, I hang on to that. But she's doing good. Physically, she's doing okay. But being away from her and not knowing what she'll do or if she'll fall, is tough. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to let you know what's going on with us. We've done lots of appointments. Not many answers. But our prayer is, Lord, give us wisdom for this season of our life. Because I know it's going to come to an end. All seasons do. All seasons wrap up and move on to a new season. So just wisdom. And I would covet your prayers for us and for myself, because I'm ending up doing everything now. I've taken care of all the responsibilities, which as a math teacher, she took care of everything, and I was not the math teacher. It has been quite the challenge, but we're moving along. So several of you already said that you've loved her and you've missed her, and she missed being here. But she just doesn't travel. So I ask for your prayers for her and for me as we move through this season of our life. Thank you so much.